Good morning. I think we are all assembled. The court is sitting six on this case. So you notice that on your screen, you will see six justices. Because we have four attorneys arguing, I want to go over the times that I've been given, which I assume you all have agreed to. So if I read something and it's not correct, I expect you to correct me so that we start out on the same page together. We're going to begin with attorney. Is it Hamadan? Hamadan? How do I say your name so I get the accent on the correct syllable? Okay.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's pronounced Hamadan.
Hamadan. Thank you very much. Okay. So you're going to have 10 minutes and then you're going to conclude with 5 minutes in rebuttal, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And Attorney McLeod, you will have 15 minutes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then Attorney Gelat, again, 15 minutes.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. And then Attorney Vandermeus, again, 15 minutes, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Before we begin, I'm going to have our marshal show you how we keep track of time when we're using Zoom. So if you look in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you'll see a green start sign when it's time for you to begin. I will also ask you to begin, so we will start on the same page. When there's 5 minutes to go, there is a yellow sign that says 5 minutes, and when it's time for you to stop, there's a red stop sign. I will hold you to that stop sign and help you keep track of it a little bit because it's a different way of keeping track of time. However, if you are answering a question that a justice has posed and you see the red sign, do not stop, finish answering the question. But when you've done answering the question, I will probably pull you in and not let you start yet on another line of argument. So with those preliminaries, are you all ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then I will call our first case of the morning, Clean Wisconsin versus DNR. Attorney Hamadan,
Your Honor.
Hamadan, with a long I. Okay, will you please begin?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Jordan Hamadan of Michael Best and Friedrich, and I represent Kinnard Farms. What are we here for today? Kinnard Farms is here to ask that you affirm the DNR Secretary's decision on the basis of advice from the then-serving Attorney General that under current law, DNR does not have the authority to impose off-site groundwater monitoring requirements or an animal unit maximum in Kinnard Farms' WPDES permit. That decision was correct when the DNR Secretary made it, and it remains correct now. Why? Because it faithfully applies the plain language of 2011 Act 21, which is the most significant amendment to the Wisconsin Administrative Procedure Act since the Act was created about a half a century ago. Act 21 is not a marginal change in administrative law. It's a seismic shift in public policy, a reassertion by the legislature over the agencies who owe their existence to the legislature, including the DNR. Now, what does the law say? Central to the discussion here today is WSSTAT 227.102M, a section of Act 21, which provides in relevant part that, quote, no agency may implement or enforce any standard, requirement, or threshold, including as a term or condition of any license issued by the agency, unless the standard, requirement, or threshold is explicitly required or explicitly permitted by statute or by a rule that has been promulgated in accordance with this subchapter. Now, the main central word in that provision is explicit. It is a strong, a consequential word. It means, according to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, fully and clearly expressed or demonstrated, leaving nothing, merely implied, unequivocal. Now, what's curious about this case is that everybody in it at least tacitly agrees that animal unit maximums and off-site groundwater monitoring are not literally enumerated in the statutes or rules governing Kinnard Farms operation or WPDES permits. Now, that failure, that absence of literal enumeration should alone end the inquiry under the plain language of 227.102M that I just read. But if we needed anything more, starting with the animal unit maximum, to seal the debate on whether current law explicitly requires or permits it, we don't have to look any further than the finding of fact number 63 made by the ALJ in his underlying decision in this case, in which he made the following finding, and I quote, no applicable statute or rule requires a WPDES permit to specify a number of animal units at a CAFO facility. If we needed anything more on the on whether current law explicitly requires or permits the imposition of off-site groundwater monitoring, we don't need to look further than Maple Leaf v. DNR, the Court of Appeals decision in 240 Wis Second 96, in which that court concluded that Wisconsin Statute Chapter 83, the statute on WPDES permits, does not expressly permit DNR to regulate off-site manure applications. So, what do the petitioners and DNR, now DNR, assert in response to this straightforward application of 227.10 sub 2M? They have two overarching objections. First, they argue that the DNR, despite the explicit language, is allowed to rely on broad grants of authority for imposing unenumerated requirements on a case-by-case basis. Because, here's how their argument goes, because in the rulemaking statute, which is 227.11, the legislature expressly said that that agencies cannot rely on broad grants of authority when it comes to rulemaking.
Counsel, can I speak there? I have a question about the impact of Act 21 on these statements of policy and purpose that are laid out in the statute. It seems to some extent that Act 21 repealed them because we really don't give them any effect under your application of Act 21, although they do expressly grant DNR all authority necessary to establish, administer, and maintain a state pollutant discharge elimination system in this case. So can you tell me, under your interpretation of Act 21, how the court is supposed to give effect to these statements of policy or purpose, or are we to just regard them as something less than a statute we need to apply?
Your Honor, I think that that can be reconciled with the straightforward application of 227.10 sub 2 in one very significant way. Those statutes are not implicitly repealed. They are not now reduced to a superfluous status. What it means is they have the authority. It's how they administer that authority. It's how they affect it. And what Act 21 does now is it requires to that general grant of authority, it requires the addition of another step, which is if you're going to impose requirements, you have to do it pursuant to a duly promulgated rule if it's not in a statute. What that means is that the DNR has that authority, but it has to promulgate specific conditions in order to be faithful to the explicit requirement. It has to promulgate a rule that enumerates those conditions.
So, Attorney Hamiden, you do agree that every permit is different and every situation is different, correct? And they're supposed to do this on a case-by-case basis. So the way I'm listening to you say this, and I'm looking at 283.31 sub 3, which talks about the department issuing permits for the discharge of any pollutant, and one of the means is to limit effluent limitations, to address effluent limitations, which is what we're dealing with here. So what I hear you saying is that what you think Act 21 does is make it so that there is no ability by DNR to monitor the conditions that they're required to maintain unless they issue a rule for each and every way in which they would monitor it. How do you address that?
Your Honor, I address that in two ways. First of all, these are certainly each permit addresses a different facility, but there are issues common to all facilities, and the general requirements to protect groundwater and so on. And these facilities are in many very significant ways very, very similar. The point is that in the rulemaking process, what the DNR can do is it can identify many conditions that might apply depending on what kind of geology there is. There are three or four significant differences in types of geology and other conditions that they might be able to impose. What we don't want happening, which is what happened here, is, and no one here is here to question the intentions of DNR. That's not the issue. The problem here is that it's clear that DNR issued these requirements in a programmatic way. For example, you look at what the ALJ did with respect to the ground, the animal unit maximum. He didn't say so much that this is the particular case where you have to have this. But what happened is we already have a 180-day storage requirement for manure. And he decided he would superimpose upon that an animal unit maximum because it's a better tool, a more useful tool for longer range management of manure.
Okay, now that Council, can you address, though, the ALJ didn't do that just generally. The ALJ explained that the animal unit maximum was necessary for Kennard's permit because Kennard had previously failed to install the markers that were required under Administrative Code NR 243.153I through K. So they failed to do what they typically do. So you're saying their hands are now tied. They'd have to go through rulemaking to get them to comply with the section that they don't comply with. Is that what I hear you saying?
No, because in that specific circumstance, those markers were subsequently installed. The answer to that problem was to enforce the requirement, which is exactly what DNR did. And then superimposed over the top of this as a better longer range management tool, not distinct and separate from the 180-day requirement, the ALJ imposed this animal unit maximum. The answer was to enforce the condition that was in place, and that's exactly what happened. So the first objection is that by the DNR as well, we've got a proscription in the rulemaking statute on us using broad grants of authority, but that proscription isn't present in the explicit statute. Well, it doesn't need to be there. There's no way those two could work together. If the statute very simply says that a requirement needs to be explicit before it can be imposed, there's no reason to then go ahead and say that and you can't use broad grants of authority for unenumerated conditions. In the broader context of the administrative law, to conclude that much would be absurd. It would require the court to conclude that on a case-by-case basis, where there are none of the protections inherent in the legislative process of rulemaking. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can finish your sentence. I don't mean for you to stop in the middle, but.
Mm-hmm. That the DNR could apply its discretion unencumbered on the basis of broad grants of authority.
Okay, thank you very much. Attorney McLeod, are you prepared to begin?
I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Eric McLeod of Hush Blackwell appears on behalf of the Wisconsin Legislature. Also with me are my colleagues Lisa Lawless and Kirsten Atanasoff, albeit not on camera this morning. I'd like to follow up with where my friend Jordan Amiden left off, and that is responding to the questions Rebecca, Justice Dallet had asked him about 283.31 sub 3, and then I'd like to discuss 283.31 sub 4, because those two provisions in the statute work hand in hand to address the very issue that we're talking about here today. 283.31 sub 3 discusses the department's authority to issue a permit, the considerations that it must look at in determining whether to issue that permit, all of which are enumerated in sub 3. And then in sub 4, it says the department shall prescribe conditions for permits issued under this section to assure compliance with the requirements of sub 3. And then it says such additional conditions shall include at least the following subject to sub 5M, not applicable here in this case. The subsequent subsections A through F are expressly required standards, conditions that must be imposed in a WPDS permit issued by the DNR, which demonstrates that the legislature knows how to specifically provide explicitly required authority as it relates to conditions to include in a WPDS permit. And the related language in sub four talks about prescribing conditions for those permits to assure compliance with the general requirements in sub three. That is an invitation to rulemaking. It is not in itself authority to impose any particular conditions. And in fact, as is evidenced by the thousands of pages of administrative rules that DNR has promulgated, as well as those that apply to CAFOs for nutrient management and other requirements, the DNR knows how to promulgate specific standards that will be included as potential conditions or as a basis for enforcing certain standards in a WPDS permit.
Council, would the DNR have to promulgate a rule for a condition that's necessary to comply with any applicable federal law or regulation as laid out in 283.31?
Yes, it would, Your Honor, unless there is a condition that's already been stated by the legislature, as is the case in sub four, where the legislature has expressly required certain conditions be included in that WPDS permit. But the general statement that the DNR must include conditions necessary to comply with federal or state law does not identify any specific standard. And there must be, at a minimum, under Act 21, under 227.10 sub 2M, there must be a standard that's articulated in a statute or a rule and a statement that says that the DNR either shall or may enforce or implement that standard, requirement, or threshold in the permit.
Would that provision constitute an explicit conferral of authority on the agency by the legislature under 227.11.2A to engage in that rulemaking?
I think that's right. And in fact, both the legislature and Kindred Farms in this case have specifically made that point in our briefs, that these are subjects that could be addressed in the rule process. So there is explicit authority under 227.11.2 for rulemaking to address these types of issues. But the point is the DNR must identify what those standards, requirements, or thresholds will be. Offsite monitoring could be identified as a standard or requirement. Animal unit maximums could be identified. But they have to be actually stated in a rule somewhere in the administrative code if they're not otherwise included in a statute. Now, I'd also like to address the argument that the DNR in Clean Wisconsin have raised, that we are requiring that any rule be cut and pasted verbatim, meaning that there's no room for any discretion on the part of an agency in the context of enforcing or implementing a standard or requirement or threshold. That's not at all what we're arguing. The term explicit, as used in Act 21, applies to the authority granted to the agency to implement or enforce a particular standard. It doesn't require that the standard to be enforced or implemented must rise to some level of specificity, or that it contain every detailed requirement that could go into that standard. But there must be a standard, and the standard has to arise in the context of a statute or rule. And as Attorney Hamiden has noted, the ALJ agreed that there were no standards that required offsite monitoring or animal units. So we fail at that basic level that there's not a standard in the first instance. The question related to that then is there authorization in a statute that says the DNR shall or it may impose that particular standard in the context of a WPDS permit? So that it's a two-step process, but we shouldn't be confused with the idea that the word explicit applies to the actual standard that exists. Again, that's the subject of rulemaking that DNR knows how to engage in. It adopts very specific rules that are implemented in the context of both a WPDS permit and other permitting related to CAFOs. So this is not something unusual that's being imposed on the DNR or any other agency. It's simply confirming, Act 21 is simply confirming that if an agency chooses to act, it must act according to that explicit authority that's been delegated to it by the legislature. Now, Act 21 also achieves a very important additional purpose, and that is to give fair notice to both the regulated community, but also to the public as to what the law is. The very nature of implied authority assumes that an agency is on a case-by-case basis, making law, determining what legal standards it will apply in a particular set of circumstances. That does not give fair notice to either the regulated community or to the public in general of what the law is, and it's inconsistent with the nature of agency authority in the first instance. Agencies exist solely on the basis of statutory authorizations from the legislature. They don't have any constitutional status to make laws. And so in order to determine what the scope of authority is that an agency can exercise, one must look to the specific language in the enabling statutes. And what Act 21 does, in addition, is to say, when you exercise certain authority, in this case, when you impose a condition in a permit, you must find the source for that condition, that standard requirement or threshold, in a statute or a rule. And that statute or rule must say that that the agency can or it must impose that standard. I think as noted previously, it's undisputed that those requirements are not provided anywhere in statute or rule. The very basis for including them is that they would be helpful, that they would be a good idea. And that really implicates the underlying question, which is who gets to make those decisions? As Attorney Hamiden had noted, this is not a question about DNR's intentions or its efforts or the ALJ's intentions to do what it thinks sounds like good policy and to impose requirements that it thinks would be helpful. But ultimately, the question is who decides. Act 21 clarifies that question. And in any case involving environmental regulation or regulation in general, there will always be a dispute about how far to go. How far should regulation go in order to ensure that we are adequately protecting the environment? That decision obviously has to be balanced against other competing interests. The statutes that seek to protect the environment have to consider our use of land, the efficient ability to engage in commerce, and a whole host of other requirements or considerations that may be implicated. It is simply not the case that in every instance we look to what the most effective requirement could be and say an agency should be able to implement a standard that it conceives would be the most effective. And when it does, there will always be the argument made by some that the agency didn't go far enough in that instance. So Act 21 simply seeks to define what that agency authority is, what must form the basis for its decisions and its actions. And if there are if there is a public debate about whether that's sufficient to do an effective enough job, That's a matter for the public policy debate and this and the potential subject for future legislative action. So I'll finish your honors with the final thoughts, which is implied agency power, which is a doctrine that was adopted by the judiciary, has been specifically rejected in Act 21. And what the legislature has done, it has said it is pulling back on the authority that it possesses and only it possesses to say that we will not allow for general statements of purpose, general delegations of authority in enabling statutes to form the basis for agency action. Only the legislature will define the scope of that agency action, and it has determined that such agency action must be explicitly conferred.
Counsel, there's different ways of interpreting the word explicitly or explicit. It could mean specific, or it could mean that it would be satisfied by a general grant of authority that is explicitly made. That's how I understand the argument on the other side. Could you address that specifically?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. The use of the term explicit in Act 21 has a specific meaning. And keep in mind, in 227 sub 11, there's reference to the term express authority that's been conferred on the agency to engage in rulemaking. So the legislature clearly chose a specific term, explicit, in this context to have a more precise meaning. Explicit in this context doesn't just mean that it is something that it's expressed or articulated. Certainly the general statement of purpose for DNR in chapter 283 is a general statement of power, and that's explicitly stated in a general provision. But Act 21 looks to the question of whether certain standards have been explicitly authorized to be imposed by the agency. Explicit being a term used to say there needs to be a statement that says you shall or you may enforce or implement a particular standard requirement or threshold. It must say that. That's the nature of explicit in this context. Not that there is a multitude of both general and specific authority that is provided by statute. One in common parlance could say that that's explicitly stated in a statute, but it's not the nature of explicit that is used in Act 21. That is a specific meaning that the court must look to. For example, throughout the course, throughout their briefs, as I may have noted before, I see that the stop sign has arisen, Your Honor.
Yes, right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Attorney Gillette, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrea Gillette, here on behalf of petitioners, respondents, Cochart et al. In this case. Also with me today is my co-counsel, Evan Feinauer. Some of these petitioners are able to watch via live feed today. This case is about ensuring clean drinking water. When your house is served by a private well, groundwater contamination affects your ability to drink water, bathe your children, and live safely and comfortably in your own home. Petitioners were concerned about contamination of their groundwater and surface water from neighboring farms' production of manure and its plans for a large expansion. And they petitioned for administrative review of the farm's water pollution discharge elimination system permit issued by DNR. They asked for conditions that would allow the farm to expand, but also protect their water and their health. In the evening of the contested case hearing set aside for public testimony, the administrative law judge heard uncontested testimony from petitioners and others in the community about widespread well contamination. He also noted the toll on the neighbors who spoke before him, including health impacts, stress, loss of business opportunities, and for some, financial ruin. As the administrative law judge stated in his final order, the proliferation of contaminated wells represents a massive regulatory failure to protect the groundwater in the town of Lincoln. Also during the contested case hearing, the judge heard detailed expert testimony about the existing permit terms as issued by DNR in the permit, including a thorough explanation of the applicable nutrient management plan, the design plan for the waste storage facility, and he determined that given all the testimony and evidence, those terms were not enough for DNR to assure compliance with the legal standards for the permit, given the issues with contamination, as well as issues in marking the waste storage facility pit. So the ALJ imposed two modest conditions to do that. My argument proceeds in four parts. First, I explain why 283.31 sub 3 and sub 4 on their own clearly and unambiguously authorize the permit conditions at issue here today. The ALJ made explicit findings that these conditions were necessary to assure compliance with the applicable effluent limitations and groundwater protection standards. Second, and specifically as to the off-site groundwater monitoring condition, through the authority of 283.31, the groundwater laws of Wisconsin and Wisconsin Statute Chapter 160 and implementing regulations explain that groundwater monitoring wells may be used in just this factual context. Third, should this court engage Act 21, we ask that it review the question of explicit authority tied to this case and to the statutory language and not accept the invitation of the farm and the legislative intervener to add provisions that appear nowhere in 227.10.2F. Fourth, I'll briefly address the procedural issue in this case regarding DNR's challenge decision in 2015. In the first year after the ALJ's decision, DNR repeatedly defended its authority to implement the conditions in briefs and letters attempting to enforce the ALJ's order. And then it abruptly and without notice or an opportunity for briefing reversed itself. We explained that in briefing that under the applicable statutes and regulations, DNR lacked authority to reverse itself. And on that basis alone, the circuit court's decision should be affirmed.
Counsel, can I take you to your first point? And will you address, please, Mr. McLeod's statement that 283.31 sub 3 and 4 are not explicit enough pursuant to 227.102M?
Your Honor, I think the idea of not explicit enough comes not from a dictionary definition or from anywhere else. Explicit means expressly conferred or clear. The legislative intervener and the farm attempt to add additional layers of meaning, for example, specifically to that definition, but that is not the definition of explicitly. Here, we have a clear statutory authority to impose these conditions. There is a list of statutory bases that provide the grounding for the conditions. And here, based on the factual findings made by the ALJ about widespread well contamination and a failure to mark the waste storage pit, there was a factual predicate to impose these clear conditions as required by statute. In addition,
I'm going to ask you to just respond to something else that was said just a little while ago. And that was Justice Dallet asked about the need to promulgate a rule for each permit. And the response was, no, that we don't need that because there are issues that are common for each facility. And in the rulemaking process, DNR can address those and DNR can address issues in a programmatic way. Can you respond to that as well, please?
Yes, Your Honor. This case comes up on judicial review of an administrative action. The administrative law judge reviewed this particular facility, reviewed down to the level of particular soil bearings at the site, looked at the groundwater flow patterns, and made fact-specific findings that related to this farm alone. The statutes provide for this kind of flexibility to impose conditions that are necessary in a particular factual context. Chapter 283 provides in numerous places a requirement to undertake rulemaking to propose particular standards. In the context of these permit conditions, however, it does not provide that. It says instead that to assure compliance with the conditions, there can be conditions to address the limitation set forth in 283.31(3). And so certainly in the permitting context, there is a need to address the fact-specific requirements that are addressed by this case.
The council, isn't it really up to the legislature or the DNR in this case through rulemaking to specify the types of permit conditions that might be imposed and then have DNR on a case-by-case basis impose the appropriate ones? Because if those specific types of conditions are not specified in the statutes or in the regulations, how is somebody subject to DNR regulation supposed to anticipate what rules might be applied to them?
Well, Your Honor, because the statute is clear and it provides a clear standard for what kind of conditions may be imposed in a fact-specific scenario, that provides the clarity that's necessary to the regulated community. I would also like to move briefly to the point about the groundwater statutes here. The groundwater statutes and the regulations implemented thereunder permit groundwater monitoring. Chapter 160 and its implementing regulations provide when the DNR sees exceedances of the groundwater standards, like the administrative law judge found when he saw an E. coli contaminated wells proximate to site 2 in the spreading fields, DNR can impose groundwater monitoring as a regulatory response. Wisconsin statute chapter 283.31(f) requires CAFOs to concentrated animal feeding operations like the farm to limit discharges in accordance with the groundwater laws. And so chapter 283 therefore requires DNR to exercise regulatory authority to implement those laws. Chapter 160 and its regulations in chapter NR 140 provide the processes that are followed to exercise this regulatory authority. And Wisconsin Administrative Code NR 140.26 explicitly provides for groundwater monitoring should there be a need to address an exceedance of the groundwater standards, as was found here. As we noted in our brief, the standard for total coliform bacteria is 0. And so any detection of fecal coliform in a well would exceed that standard. But Your Honor, to return to your question, the statute provides clear and explicit authority to impose the conditions here. 227.10(2)(m) does not say that the explicit authority must come from a rule. It says it can come from either a statute or a rule. And here, the legislature has made a clear authority, has established clear authority under 283.31(3) and (4).
Well, that's what the whole case turns on. How explicit does, or what does explicit mean? And how explicit does the condition have to be? Because, you know, you can read 283.31(4) to be a very broad grant of authority. It gives DNR authority to prescribe conditions to assure compliance with (3), but it doesn't say what those conditions are or what those types of conditions could be. And so that's what I'm concerned about, because it strikes me that Act 21 was the legislature stepping in to reclaim some of that delegated authority that it gave to the DNR, that the legislature was making a statement that not just with respect to the DNR, but with respect to other agencies, that it's going to be the legislature stepping in to say, no, there's got to be a more explicit, again, to come back to that word and its meaning, which is what this case turns on. There has to be a more explicit grant of authority to an agency like the DNR.
Your Honor, I think it's important to look at the definition of explicit can be explicit and broad. I think the legislative intervener and the farm have tried to suggest that it must also be narrow, but that is not in the dictionary definitions of explicit. And so because it can allow for explicit and clear authority That is found here under 283.31. And the conditions necessary to assure compliance are tied to the specific categories that are listed in sub three.
As a follow-up to that, is it fair to really say we've got a number of statutes that we're citing here? We have a number of, to look at the administrative code, but that this case boils down to something as difficult or easy as how do you define explicit? Do you define it narrowly or broadly? Does explicit mean specific? It seems to me that your counsel on the other side are advancing that explicit requires specific, and that broad application or broad interpretation cannot be explicit. Can you respond to that?
Your Honor, I think that the legislature knew how to use the word specific. It could have included in 227.10 sub 2M that in order for a threshold standard or to be included in a permit, there would need to be both explicit and specific authority. It did not use that word. And so I think the better reading of the statute in context with the regulatory programs that, you know, interact with 227.10 2M is that explicit can also mean broad. Otherwise, to curtail the authority to administer and maintain the permitting program here could run afoul of other conditions. For example, in 283.31 sub 3, there's the need to comply with federal standards. And so if the authority here is read in a crabbed way such that the agency is no longer allowed to comply with federal standards when it sees that factual circumstances on the ground require that, that could lead to a situation where the EPA will find that this implementation of permitting under the Clean Water Act no longer meets the federal standards and will require the EPA to step in and exercise authority on top of the DNR. And that cannot be what the legislature intended here. So the better reading of the statute is that explicit also can encompass explicit and broad. So just to clarify a few points about our argument related to the animal unit limit. 283.31 also provides the statutory basis in this case. The ALJ examined the farm's failure to comply with the 180-day storage limitation by failing to have markers installed to show when the farm had reached the storage limit. And so on these facts, the court found that the animal unit limit was a useful longer-term management tool to ensure compliance with the storage requirement. Finally, I'll briefly address the procedural argument here today. When the DNR changed its mind in 2015 and stopped implementing the administrative law judge's decision, it was acting contrary to the applicable statutes and regulations here. There is nothing under 227.46 sub 3 or Wisconsin Administrative Code NR 2.155 that allows for the result that the DNR took. There were particular time limits that addressed what the DNR could do once the administrative law judge had issued a decision, and none of those allowed what the DNR undertook in this case. And for this separate reason, we would ask that the court affirm the circuit court.
Counsel, do we need to get into that issue, or is it moot? I think the DNR is taking the position that it's moot because the farm is operating under a new permit, so we don't need to look back at to whether the prior permit, we don't need to look into that procedural issue with respect to the prior permit.
I see that I'm out of time, but I'll respond. Yeah. Just
yes, do respond. Thank you.
This issue is not moot. The effect of the DNR reversing its decision was that it stopped implementing the administrative law judge's decision and did not include these permit conditions either in the 2012 permit or in the subsequent 2018 permit. Should the court find that that 2015 reversal was improper, that would sort of unwind things to the point that the administrative law judge's decision is the decision of the agency and must be implemented. We also submit that mootness exceptions apply here, but in shortness of time, I'll rely on my brief for that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Thank you. Attorney Vandermoos, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jennifer Vandermoos on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. This case is about faithfully reading the statutes that give clear authority to the DNR to prescribe flexible conditions for WFDs permits, which assure that state and federal requirements are met, and which benefit permittees as much as they protect public health. This court should affirm the circuit court because on this record, DNR had statutory authority to prescribe the off-site monitoring requirement and animal unit limit for the 2012 permit. This court should not reach the moot procedural issue of whether DNR could reconsider its agency decision, but if the court takes it up, the circuit court's decision should be affirmed without a remand to the agency. Turning to the issue of statutory authority, as this court has instructed, we look to the relevant statutes and rules. We've discussed Section 283.31 sub 4 today, and I would emphasize that it requires DNR to prescribe conditions in a WFDs permit to ensure compliance with the requirements of subsection 3, which include effluent limitations and groundwater protection standards. The DNR does agree with the different sources of authority that Attorney Gillott discussed, and we would add that DNR is allowed to take certain responses if a substance has been exceeded, and such responses in NR 140 include the installation and sampling of groundwater monitoring wells. That chapter applies to all facilities, activities, and practices that may affect groundwater quality and are regulated under Chapter 283, which, of course, the WFDs program is regulated under. Now here, based on site-specific facts in this record, the ALJ found that the level of groundwater contamination, including E. coli bacteria in the area at or near Kindred site, is very unusual, and nearby neighbors testified about being sickened by E. coli contaminated well water, short distances from Kindred site and its land spreading fields. This was nothing short of a public health crisis. And given this, a groundwater monitoring plan, which should include two offsite wells, if practicable, would assure compliance with the groundwater protection standard setting total coliform bacteria to zero and the effluent limitation that prohibits fecal contamination of a well. Further, an animal unit limit would assure compliance with the 180-day manure storage effluent limitation.
Counsel, in regard to the off-site monitoring, I understand how the owners of the animal feeding facility are subject to regulation, but how is their authority in the DNR to put wells on other people's property to monitor?
Yes, Your Honor. So the ALJ's findings said to impose the off-site monitoring requirement if practicable, and as discussed in the ALJ's decision, there was a note as to whether voluntary participation of landowners was required. So that was accounted for in the decision. And the question here that I want to make sure the court is focused on is whether, because this is judicial review, the findings support the DNR's authority as a matter of law to impose these conditions. And here, that authority is met.
Where is the authority, if you can point to me, to put a well on someone's property who's not affiliated with this animal feeding operation? That's what I'm having a little trouble with.
Right. And as I said, the ALJ accounted for the possibility that voluntary participation would be
needed. Hey, what if they don't volunteer? What if they don't volunteer? So you've got what you want us to uphold as actually the law of the case, but I don't think we have authority over the places where these offsite wells are going to be. Now, I understand if people consent, that's a different thing, but that's not what is bothering me, I mean, if people consent, then that's fine. But if they don't, where is the authority to do what was directed? That's what I'm wondering about.
Sure. And Your Honor, again, this is judicial review. The agency decision that the DNR adopted is the ALJ's decision. And so that particular question is not actually before the court, because that's not what the ALJ ordered. The ALJ ordered offsite monitoring if practicable. And the question is whether the DNR did this lawfully within its authority. And it did here.
Okay, so you're relying on the if practicable. So if nobody consents, then they don't have to do it. Is that correct?
So, Your Honor, again, we also have the authority under NR 140 that I discussed and that Attorney Gillott discussed too. But what we're focusing on is what happened in this agency decision.
Well, the decision you're telling me says if practicable, and I'm trying to focus on that too. And what I'm asking you for an answer to is if no one consents, then are off-site monitoring wells not a condition that needs to be addressed?
Your Honor, the authority that DNR has is to impose conditions that assure compliance with effluent limitations and right. groundwater protection standards.
Okay.
Off-site right. wells, if practicable here, if would assure compliance with effluent limitations and groundwater protection standards. We don't think that the court needs to reach the question of whether the voluntary participation is needed, but the ALJ did say that the voluntary participation would be needed. So that's the decision here. Now, the other prescribed condition was the animal unit limit, and the DNR ALJs found that the 180-day storage requirements was not being met due to the failure to include those markers. And so the animal unit limit, though not used often, would assure compliance with this condition. Now, I want to turn to Kindred Farms and the intervener's interpretation of DNR's authority. And we've discussed that a lot today. And it's our position that it's wrong for a number of reasons. And we would add that it is important to remember that this is judicial review, and we also would invite the court to stay focused on the record in this case. But nothing in Act 21 states an intent to repeal or alter the meaning of longstanding regulatory statutes, including 28331. To hold otherwise would require this court to ignore the clear language in 28331 and would violate settled principles of law, including that the legislature cannot pass a statute in an attempt to bind the court with a particular construction of an earlier enacted statute. Further, what 227.10.2M actually says is consistent with the application of 28331 here. Sub 4 requires DNR to prescribe conditions to assure compliance with effluent limitations and groundwater protection standards. The findings in this record are not in dispute, and they show that the animal unit limit and offsite monitoring condition assure compliance with effluent limitations and groundwater protection standards. These conditions are therefore explicitly permitted by statute. The interveners and Kindred are claiming that the grant of authority in 28331 is not explicit authority, but that's incorrect. 28331 gives DNR the authority to prescribe permit conditions on a case-by-case basis. Now, this court has recognized that this type of authority is common in environmental statutes, and the framework like this 28331 is designed for DNR to use its expertise to make what by necessity are fact-specific determinations. There is a reason why the statute does not require these particular conditions to be placed into rules. It's because every situation is different, and DNR works with the permittee to tailor conditions that meet the facility while also accounting for its obligations to protect public health. So that's not only what the plain language says, it just makes common sense when thinking about the nature of these permit conditions. And contrary to a suggestion in a non-party brief and at the end of the intervener's reply brief, these conditions themselves are not unpromulgated rules because they are not general standards of application. So we've also discussed 227.11.2a a little bit today, and I'd like to address that. That section...
Before you move on to that, statute. I want to pose the same question to you that I posed to Council for Clean Wisconsin. Isn't it up to the legislature or the rulemaking process to specify the types of permit conditions that DNR could impose? So that would then give DNR the authority to impose these types of conditions, but it would also be fair to the regulated community, which then would be on notice that these are the types of conditions that could be imposed. That would give DNR the flexibility it needs to impose them without it coming as a surprise, perhaps, to those who are regulated by the agency, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, to address that, the regulated community is on notice as to the requirements under subsection 3 that need to be met. And the reason that the statute is not designed to spell out every single permit condition that assures compliance with those requirements is because there is just no way that the universe of different scenarios could be accounted for in a set of promulgated rules. That's why the statute is designed the way that it is. So the notice is in the statute. And as we saw here on this record, even though Kinnard Farms had that 180-day manure storage effluent limitation, it was not complying with it. And so DNR issued an animal unit limit. And again, the statute gives DNR the ability to make these specific decisions using its expertise. This case is not about questioning what the decision was here. It's whether it has the ability to make those decisions. And it unquestionably does.
Can you briefly just address Attorney Hamiden's comment that they don't need the animal unit requirements? They can just enforce what wasn't being complied with by Kinnard Farms, the markers.
So there are different ways to enforce the 180-day requirement. Animal unit limit is one. Enforcement perhaps is another. In this particular case, the ALJ made the decision based on expertise and the authority in 28331 that the animal unit limit was appropriate for this facility. Perhaps in the next facility or in the next set of facts, that would not be appropriate, but that was the decision here. And the question is whether DNR had the authority to make that decision. So 227, I would like to go to 227.11. That statute is a rulemaking statute, and this is not a rulemaking case. The DNR disagrees that it's appropriate to map 227.11 onto the analysis of 227.10.2M, which is that no agency may implement or enforce any standard, requirement, or threshold, including terms or conditions of a license unless they're explicitly permitted or required. There are two different statutes, and we should not be looking at 227.11. But even if we were to assume it's relevant here, I would note that DNR is not relying on a statement of policy and purpose. And that whether those statements, what effect they have, is really not at issue in this case, because we're not even relying on that statute. We're relying on the clear statute that gives DNR authority to prescribe permit conditions in 283, 31, 3, and 4. I would also like to note that aside from the fact that the interpretation of 227.10.2M is not correct as a matter of law, if this court were to hold in favor of Kinnard and the intervener's position, it could have very problematic consequences. And Attorney Gillette touched on those a little bit, and we discussed them in our brief. The DNR cannot issue a WFDES permit that fails to include conditions necessary to meet federal and state requirements. And not all federal requirements are promulgated in state rules. Interpreting Act 21 as eliminating DNR's case-by-case authority to prescribe conditions and permits that assure compliance with state and federal requirements until a state rule is promulgated. I see my time is up. May I just briefly conclude?
Yes, please, just finish your thought.
It could stall the process for issuing permits across the state and could threaten the federal delegation of DNR's WFDES permitting authority, since DNR must comply with federal requirements to have its authority under the WFDES program. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Hamiden, are you ready for rebuttal?
I am ready for rebuttal, and I'm going to take Attorney Vandermeuse's cue, and let's focus not on the rulemaking statute for the moment, but on the one its central issue here, which is 227.10 sub 2. And while we've been with Mr. McLeod accused of inflating or otherwise layering onto the term explicit, the definition of the term explicit, we did no such thing. I simply read the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of it, which requires, in my view, for it to be much more precise than here. Now, if you look at the wording of that statute, it's important that it uses the definite article. And what I'm talking about, it says that, the agency cannot impose a requirement, implement any requirement, unless the requirement is explicitly required or explicitly permitted. So now let's, and those, it's undisputed, aren't. The specific requirements are not anywhere in the statutes. So now let's apply the interpretation that you've been invited to apply by DNR and by the petitioners here, which is that as long as there's the authority to implement conditions, that somehow meets the requirement. But where's the end point? I mean, we're talking about farms here with several thousands of acres of land base that they apply manure on, governed by thousands of pages of what's called a nutrient management plan that they have to comply with and that the DNR can enforce. Are we now going to be subject to the potential that the DNR, under this, what they perceive to be the broad authority, is going to make us go to these hundreds of fields and sink expensive wells in every single one? Now, something that significant, really, it's programmatic, number one. It's a tool in their toolbox. Something that programmatic really needs to be put into a rule, and that's where then 227.11 comes in. Now, we've heard about there being a public health crisis. Now, that's not a reason to disregard the law, as we've learned in Palmman and other cases recently. It's precisely the time to follow the law, because it's in reaction to those issues where there is the greatest temptation to layer on where the law doesn't allow it. This is not a case of whether or not the agency has the power to implement a certain requirement. It's how they implement it. Do they implement it because they're imbued with limitless authority to respond to specific circumstances, or do they exercise their authority in accordance with explicit authorization in rules? Now, that's, of course, circumstances are going to differ from farm to farm, but we should know that the DNR has the expertise, it has the history to be able to promulgate a rule that reasonably contemplates categories of conditions that they might have to impose in response to certain sets of circumstances. Kinnard Farms is not the only farm built on this type of geology. Kinnard Farms is not the only one that may have forgotten to place a marker in terms of the 180-day requirement. It's not the only farm that has any of these circumstances, that we can suppose has any of the circumstances which may have led to the rulings in this case. This is not a case where there are going to be consequences other than agencies, and the DNR in particular, is going to have to start doing a job that they're not necessarily used to, that where a broad authority to impose conditions is contained in the statutes, they need to go to work and write the rules and get the input so that...
I'm just going to stop you right there, because... Okay. I'm going to take issue with, first of all, your characterization of the other side piling on. No one's piling on. We're trying to figure out what the definition of explicit is. I don't think you taking a swing at them is particularly fair just because you get to bat last. Number two, you can argue all you want, and it's probably a good argument that what the effect of our decision should not be something that we should be worried about, that we should be looking at the law. But for them to say, for you to say in the next sentence, the only result of this is going to be that DNR is going to do whatever we're telling them to do, that's just not true. There are going to be consequences. And whether or not we're supposed to look at them is one thing. But for you to, again, bat last and say that there's not going to be any consequences based on our decision is patently false. But there were consequences. You're using the Palm example. There were consequences. There are huge consequences because of the Palm decision. So I just got to stop you in that argument right now because I don't think it's right and I don't think it's fair.
My time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you all. Thank you all very much. This is a very interesting and very, very complicated case. Your briefs were very helpful, though I have to tell you, there were a lot of them when you add them all together. And you did a very good job at oral argument. I kind of wondered how it would go with four of you arguing today, but you did a fine job and you've been very helpful to the court. We will now take a recess while we get set up for our second case of the morning. We are adjourned.